This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And I'm pleased today to welcome a friend of a friend to the show. Our guest is a Grammy-nominated blues, soul, and Americana singer, songwriter, and author. She has 16 albums to her credit, and if my memory serves, one or two of those albums feature former Root Doctor keyboard player Jim Alfredson. She was named the Blues Foundation's B.B. King Entertainer of the Year in 2009, becoming only the second female after Coco Taylor to be so honored. Wow, talk about an honor indeed, and in immense company nonetheless. Her new album, Back to Me, is due for release March 28th, and pre-orders are being taken now. Genova Magnus, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Time Signatures. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Boy, that was a heck of an introduction there. Thank you very much. It's like, whoa, really? Did I do all that?
Yeah, you gave me a big pile to pick from, you know?
You know, it's, I am a Michigander in origin, and if nothing else, we do know how to work hard.
Indeed. Now, it begs the question, where in Michigan?
I'm so sorry. I was coughing.
I'm sorry.
What was the question?
Where in Michigan?
Mount Clemens specifically, but most folks other than Michiganders don't really have a clue of where that is. So I normally just stay Detroit.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Northern suburb. They call it the Clem these days.
Yep. Yep. My father was a patrolman, first precinct downtown on Bobian.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, yeah. Genova, let's get this ball rolling here. What are your earliest memories of music?
Oh, well, that would be my father singing to me. He was a really great singer, and he played harmonica as well.
Oh, wow.
And so it would be him singing to me and playing that harmonica, and then ultimately his record collection, which was pretty cool. He had a pretty cool record collection. He had some great old country stuff. He was originally from the South. So he had great, like, what I think of as legit country.
Sure.
Hank Williams, Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, you know, Patsy Cline. And then he had a bunch of you know, he had some Ray Charles stuff, and he had Bull Moose Jackson, you know, 78, because we played 78s back then too. I am metal. That would have been my real true introduction. It went from there probably to the Beatles, the Stones, because that was what was on the radio, and that's what my older brothers were listening to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, did you have any favorite bands or songs that you just had to keep playing over and over again when you were younger?
Well, what we're talking about, when I had the opportunity to make the choice of what was getting listened to. Okay, so that's a little bit older. So then we're up into the Beatles.
Yep.
I was pretty crazy about the Beatles. I really wanted to go see the Beatles, and the two neighbor girls that lived up the hill, their dad let them go to see the Beatles, and I really wanted to go, and I was begging and begging and begging, and they got me a ticket.
Wow.
They got me a ticket to go see the Beatles. I'm talking 60s, right? So
yeah. Oh yeah.
They were first, you know, happening here in the States, and my dad wouldn't let me go because they were long hairs and he wasn't having it. And so he said no. And I was really upset the way little girls can get upset and punish daddy by not speaking to him for, you know, I don't know, 4 months. I didn't talk to my dad for something like that, 3-4 months. I was just mad at him. All I would do was just like glare at him, you know. And one day, it's a pretty funny story now. I didn't think it was funny at the time. One day he came home from work and he said, okay, I'm sorry I didn't let you go, but I got you this instead. And he handed me a vinyl, an album, supposedly autographed by the band, but it wasn't the Beatles. It was the Monkees.
Oh, wow.
Said, these guys are great. They're just as good as the Beatles. And I was like, they are not as good as the Beatles. Nobody's as good. You know, I mean, it was just like, I was not done punishing him, you know? And, and so, yeah, he gave me this vinyl that I'm sure his pals at work signed after a couple months, kind of a thing. You know what I mean? Probably went and had lunch that day and they went, give her a monkeys album. She'll calm down. And it was like, no, not quite. So, yeah.
He tried. Hath no fury like a woman scorned, huh?
That's right. Even at, you know, age 9.
Yeah. Well, how about the blues? Talk about your baptism into the blues for a moment, if you would.
You know, early on, my father had the Bull Moose Jackson records and, you know, the Ray Charles records, which had a tremendous amount of blues in them. Nat King Cole, who was really technically jazz, but really rode the line on that stuff. Some, you know, a lot of blues influence there for Nat King Cole. And so that would have been, and of course the early country music has a tremendous, you know, Hank Williams had a tremendous blues influence, you know?
Yes, he did.
And so I now understand that that would be where it began. Later on, it would be, you know, when I was the ripe old age of, you know, and then of course, wait, let me just back up a second. There's going to be a blues influence with all the Beatles material as well. All the early Beatles material. Those guys were listening to Little Richard. I mean, it was Little Richard reportedly that taught Paul McCartney himself how to do that really high-pitched scream. That was Little Richard, man.
Wow. You know?
So yeah, more blues influence there, but, and peripherally the Stones. I didn't really have the Stones records, but I couldn't help but hear them on the radio. James Brown on the radio, certainly. But then when I was the ripe old age of 14, in the same year, I saw Otis Rush and I saw B.B. King live.
Oh, wow.
And I'm telling you, it took me. Like, it literally took me hostage. That experience of those artists at that point, which is like, you know, early 70s.
Yeah.
It was devastating in the best way possible. And I started to chase that experience. I had to have that feeling again. I had to have that experience, that total desperation that Otis Rush sang with, and what how he played his guitar upside down, left-handed guy, and B.B. King, and that intensity, you know, that's a platinum stand. That ain't even a gold standard, man. That's a platinum, you know, standard there. And so I chased that with everything I had. Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, I read in an interview, because I love to do homework when I'm getting ready to interview somebody, that you didn't start out as a singer. Now, I'd love to hear that story. And what did you do to be involved in the music world?
I always wanted to sing. I was the little kid that, if anybody had been paying any kind of close attention, they might have seen it. Parents today might see that stuff, but my folks didn't. I knew all the words to all the commercials on TV. All of them. The melodies memorized, like, boop, instantaneous. Mm-hmm. all the work, you know, I can sing you floor covering commercials from 1962. I really can. It's funny. A little embarrassing. And all the TV theme songs, knew them all, cold. That would later on, with these experiences with the music, and like a, not unlike many adolescents, you know, I was growing up and kind of wondering, quite frankly, what the hell happened and who these people were in my family, and they just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I was looking for a connection.
Yeah.
Music. It was like a absolute lightning bolt. That Otis Rush thing was like a lightning bolt that just arced off his guitar and across the nasty little funky bar that I was hiding in, and grabbed my heart, ripped it out of my chest, and took it with him. It was really very visceral in those moments. And so I always wanted to be a singer. That's a long-winded way of telling you that.
Yeah.
So I get to 1978, and I got tossed around a lot. I have one of those kind of rough childhood stories. The beauty of that today is that it no longer defines me.
Mm-hmm.
I am free to, truly free in my heart and in my mind to speak about those experiences. It turns out that's important for other people who have had a rocky road, for them to understand that they're not alone. So I really wanted to be a musician. I really desperately wanted to be a singer at the ripe old age of 22, and I thought I couldn't do it. I didn't believe it. I had had a few relationships, one in particular that was very dark, with a fella that I lived with. It was extremely dark, and he was a musician, and I would try to like sing around the house and stuff, and he would yell at me and tell me to stop and tell me I sounded like a cat in an alley and horrible, and who do you think you are? And it was very, very, very dark. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
I believed him, you see. And so by the time I got to 22, that was when I was 19. By the time I got to 22, I was like, well, I just can't. I can't sing. But I know that if I am not near music, in it somehow, around musicians, I need to be in it. I need to swim in this water. If I don't do that, I'm going to die. And it'll kill me. I'll die from a broken heart. And so I thought, you know what? I mean, I cried for several days about that decision that I made. And then I got up in classic Magnus Scottish blood descent, you know, stubbornness. And I thought, fine, I'll do the next best thing. I'll become a recording engineer. And so I found some scholarships to go to school to learn about electronics and engineering. And then I hustled my way into an internship at a local recording studio. And I talked these people into giving me a job as an intern. And they were like, well, what's your experience? And I'm like, none, zero. I have none. But, you know, I'll learn anything. And I'm a super fast learner. And I can answer your phones. And I don't mind cleaning your bathroom. And blah, 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 blah. All of those things were assets as far as they were concerned.
Sure.
So I got that job at that recording studio. And it put me near it. It let me be near musicians. And, oh, my God, the process of recording. And I had a job answering their phones, and I was the assistant that was in charge of duplicating cassettes. That's how long ago it was. Cassettes were the art. And duplicating cassettes on these big machines that had like, you know, four slaves at a time. And I would do this cassette duplication. And every once in a while, they'd let me help them with a recording session. Ooh, I got to be in there. I actually got to cut tape with a razor blade.
Very cool.
I was very good at that stuff. I was really good at setting up mics and doing all that stuff. And it was kind of novel for all these guys to have this young woman around and blah, blah, blah. And I, late session one night, my head is asleep in the front reception area. I'm my head's down on the desk and I'm literally dead out of sleep. And there's a session going on in the back. Songwriter and the engineer buzzes up and he goes, get in here. And I go, what's going on? And he goes, you used to sing, right? And I went, no, I don't do that. I don't do that. And he was going, no, I'm pretty sure you used to sing. And I went, yeah, man, I don't. He goes, get your butt back here because you're going to sing or you're fired.
Oh boy.
Literally, or you're fired. And I was like,
wow.
Well, he's like, this is not a negotiation. You want the job? Get back here. Oh my God, I died 1,000 deaths between that front desk and that, you know, recording room. And he stuck me in front of the microphone and said, here's the lyrics, listen to the melody. I want you to sing. This is just a demo. It's just a songwriter's demo. And I sang, and they recorded it. And the next day, I got a phone call from the songwriter. His name was Herman Jones.
Wow.
And he said, you're really good. And I went, no, man, no, that's not. And he goes, no. I want to know if you'll sing some other stuff for me. I have these demos. I need somebody to sing them so I can sell the songs. And that's where... Once again, and I get very emotional about this, okay?
Yeah.
The music came and got me.
Quite literally.
it literally came and got me.
Yeah.
And dragged me back to it, dragged me back into the center. What mad fortune that was, you know?
Indeed.
I see it now. I couldn't see it at the time. I was mortified.
Yeah. I can only imagine.
Yeah. Couldn't listen to my own voice. It was like, So it's been a long road, hasn't it?
Yeah. But with that serendipitous opportunity came an opportunity for you to go into a different direction. So at what point in life did you actually decide that the life of a musician and singer was in the cards for you?
You're going to laugh at me and you get to. And so do the listeners out there. In my 40s,
really?
I was already making records. But I was doing this thing we used to call it when I was a kid, whistling in the dark. You're scared to death. You know there's a monster under the bed. You know damn well if you put your foot down, that monster is going to snatch your leg and rip you off the bed and pull you under the bed and chew you up or whatever it's going to do, scare you. Make you wet the bed, and which I did for years on that story alone. I was terrified that there was a monster under the bed for real. And so I just had some sort of place I put it in my head. I was doing it. I was around musicians. I was gigging. I was jamming. I was doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't really believe it. I was doing this thing we used to call it when I was a kid. We called it whistling in the dark. Nothing to see here. There's no monster under my bed. I'm going to get up and just go use the bathroom because my mom will kill me if I wet the bed again. Na, 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 na. You know, literally for years I did that. I know it sounds insane and it kind of is. But I don't care. I was, you got to be a bit crazy to do this thing. So it wasn't until I was well into my 40s that I started to actually believe that this was where I was supposed to be.
I have to ask you, it's not part of my interview, but I have to ask you, what was the defining moment that made you realize that this is where you belonged?
It wasn't one. It would have been a series of moments because okay. I was very attached in the illusion that I was safe if I didn't have hope, if I didn't try, if I didn't commit. It was literally, I'll tell you, there was a moment, but so here it is, me again, figuring like, I'll just do this music as like a side hustle thing, but I'm not really committed to it. And I'm going to do this other job over here. So I have a job. I'm living in LA. And I lived in Phoenix for 6 years and gigged around Phoenix and played with some heavy, heavy cats there. And I worked a lot, but I did not believe it for a minute. So now I'm living in LA. I get this job working for this composer, a very successful composer for film and television. And his job is to write the music and shake hands and have cocktails with the clients. And sure. My job was to run his $500,000 business a year. And in the 80s, $500,000 on a business, writing songs was just all right, man. That would just fine.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want that job when I took it, but I desperately needed the money. So I took the job. I ended up becoming very good friends with that guy, worked for him for 5 years. It was his birthday. There were two things that happened. His birthday, and I had to be at the birthday party, him and his wife, big soiree at the house, catered, you know, valet to park all the fancy-ass cars. And I knew they were going to have a jam session. And I told my then husband, you know, I want to make sure before we get there, I want you to understand that we need to leave before this jam happens, because I know what's going to happen, because he's going to get a couple drinks in him, and then he's going to insist that I sing with the band. And the band was going to be some of the heaviest session hitters in Los Angeles. And I wanted nothing to do with it. I do not, you know. And he was like, okay, all right, don't worry, honey, we'll leave before then. And sure enough, a couple cocktails in, the party's happening, it's great vibe. There's like, you know, there's like 100 people in this house, and the band is a beautiful trio, piano player playing the baby grand and upright bass and a cool guitar player, and they're playing some stuff, and my boss starts yelling over the din of the noise in the crowd, and he's like, hey, he called me Jay, you need to sing. And I was like, you know, I'm putting my coat on, we're leaving, I'm so sorry, thanks for asking, I gotta go, we gotta go. And then he gets his friends to go, no, and they gang up on me at the party. Oh, no. It was very fun for them. And
you're giving dirty looks to your husband, right? Because he didn't get you out of there in time.
I'm like, I'm trying to give him the side eye, and I can't even do that. I'm frozen. Now I'm terrified. These are heavy. This is Sid Page. If you don't know who Sid Page is, just Google Sid Page. Sid Page was there, had his violin, wanted to jam. And I'm like, no. And he's like, come on, just do one blues. Just poke me in the eye with a chopstick, will you? So I'm like, okay. And the pressure was too much. It was going to be too embarrassing. I still needed that job. So I look at the piano player and I go, dude, 12 bar blues? And he goes, sure, no problem. What's the song? And I said, Billy's Blues, Billie Holiday. And he goes, oh yeah, great tune. I go, yeah, it kind of swings. He's like, yeah, no problem. And I go, B flat. And he goes, cool. And I counted it off, which I had learned to do that kind of a thing then.
Sure.
And they started playing and I opened my mouth. And I've for a long, long time, for most of my career, I've had a rather large voice. And I opened my mouth and I started to sing. And the crowd went shh. And they went deafeningly. I mean, it's like out of a movie or some crap.
Yeah.
They went deafeningly silent and they were like. And then they look at Bill, my boss, and they're like, what the hell, man? What the hell? Why have you been hiding her? This guy's, Bill's wife, is like number one triple scale session singer in Los Angeles. And she was doing that. And so I was, you know, I finished the song, uproarious applause, one more. Oh my God, scratch my face off. I do another song, I grab my coat and I ran out the front door. You know, Sid Page wanted a jam. I was dying because it was breaking a part of me that
yeah.
I held very close. It was an illusion that it would keep me safe if I didn't have hope for that, if I didn't try. Another year goes by in that job, and then I turned 40, and we're in a session in Los Angeles, big session, doing a bunch of Honda commercials. And it's my 40th birthday. And we're on break, and Bill brought this great-looking cake in, and everybody's singing happy birthday, da-da-da. It's really fun on the break, and they all go off to smoke cigarettes or whatever else they were doing at that time before we start the session up again. And I'm in the break room with Bill and the cake. And he goes, so what'd you wish for? And it's just me and him. And we're pals. And I go, I got to tell you something, man. This is hard. And he goes, go ahead. You can trust me. We're cool. And I looked at him and I said, I quit. And he goes, what? What do you mean? I said, I gotta quit, man. It's been 5 years. And he goes, what did I do? I said, it has nothing to do with you. I gotta go. I have to play music. I have to. And so that year was a pretty epic year for me in this internal transition.
Sure.
I knew, you know, whatever the clock with turning 40, there was all of that stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I had to try. I knew that if I gave half as much focus and time to the music as I was spending working for this guy over 40 hours a week, every week for 5 years. If I gave 25 hours a week dedicated to music, I might do okay. I might. It didn't matter to me that the world, that everybody in Los Angeles was like going, you can't make any money playing blues. 'Cause I've had that part of me that's, for a long time, that's gone, you know, you go ahead and keep telling yourself that. That's a story. You want to believe it? You go for it. I'm just going to go over here and I'm going to just do my thing and I'll see you when I see you. So I didn't know I had that in me for the longest time. But that's what happened. And then it started going great guns. I don't know, you know, my ex-husband is a brilliant writer. And definitely like a hermit type individual. Mm-hmm. All he wanted to do was like sit in his room and write songs. And if he didn't have to engage with with humanity, it would have been fine for him. You know, I'm the one that's like, hey, da 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 da. You know, here's Johnny. Like, that's me, right? Somehow. And I said, we need to record your songs. And he was like, oh, we don't have any money. And I'm like, that doesn't matter. We try anyway. So I had that thing. I had that thing going. We try anyway. And so that was the first, that was my second album. I had a live recording before that, before I was married to him. But then that was the second album. That album's called It Takes One to Know One. And it did really well. It did really well. And then Europe started to happen because of that album. So, you know, here's my question. What would you be if you didn't try?
Right.
I'd sad. You'd be really sad. You might be mad. Gotta try.
Definitely. You have been called outspoken and fearless in naming injustice and speaking truth to power, Janneva.
Thank you.
I'd like you to talk about that powerful side of your persona. And obviously, we've already seen flashes of it in this presentation today on, in the interview. But I'd like to hear you talk about that just a little bit.
That's a pretty cool question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that.
That's a compliment. Thank you.
I am, for those of us that are old enough to understand the reference, I am the burning bed woman. If you don't know that story, which is a horrible, horrible true story, and sadly not the only story of that kind of thing, let me just put a pin in that. I understand today that I owe my ancestors. I owe them. I didn't understand that for the very, very, very long time, but I do understand it today. I owe my ancestors. Genetically, there's something in me that just doesn't quit. I keep getting up. And isn't it something like, you know, and any boxer knows it's the truth, amateur or pro, it ain't how many times you get knocked down, baby, it's how many times you get up.
Yes.
Got to get up. And if it takes you a while, all right, get up. And that was very much a part, I believe today, I understand today, of my father's genealogy. So half Scottish and half German. But that Scottish side, I don't know if you've ever known any people from Scotland. They're pretty formidable.
Yes, they are.
Pretty bullheaded. They're pretty strong. So I see that now. I can see it now. I didn't see it for the longest time. I just, how strong. How strong the women on my dad's side of the family are. It's stunning to me. I walked around for a long, 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 long time thinking something was wrong with me because I just didn't seem to have the capacity to quit. I couldn't quit. And I wanted to quit. I really wanted to quit. And I couldn't quit. I couldn't make it stick. I'd quit 1,000 times this or 1,000 times that. I'd quit life. I quit a bunch of stuff and it wouldn't stick. And I was bewildered by that. I went to a family reunion, my dad's side of the family reunion. And I didn't really want to go. I didn't know those people. I didn't want to know those people. They had not, as far as I could tell, they hadn't really shown up for my family when things were really, really hard. My parents died when I was a kid. They both took their own lives separately. There were lots and lots of problems. And this, there was this massive, my mother was an only child. My father came from a family of nine. There were lots of uncles, a couple of aunts in there. And from what I could see at the time, what I understood at the time was nobody did nothing. Not one of them. Not one of them. My Aunt Eleanor, my dad's youngest sister, showed up when mom passed, but she couldn't stay. Anyway, there was a lot that went on after those losses. So I get this opportunity to go, we get invited to this family reunion, me and my siblings. There were five kids. There were five of us in my family and the two parents, right? So, you know, I call my sister. I'm like, you know, I'm not going. Are you going? No. Who cares about those people? We don't need, you know, blah, blah, blah. Comes down to it's like, well, our other cousin who we were in touch with, I was in touch with, my cousin Toy, calls me. She goes, I'm going to go. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? She goes, no, we're going. Mom and I think you should go. And I was like, I'm not going. You're nuts. Have a good time. Click. Call my sister. Toy's going. She goes, what? I mean, so it was like that, just like in the movies. What do you mean? Oh, my God. Ba-da-da-da-da. Ba-da-da-da-da. All five of us, me and my other four siblings, went. Absolutely unprecedented. And what I experienced in that weekend was an opening in my perception of what was going on and what had happened. And I saw these, like I don't know, 73 cousins on my daddy's side. That's a big, big family.
Big family, yeah.
Cousins, second cousins, so on and so forth. And it was stunning for me because what I saw, what I witnessed in real time, I mean, the men were the men, and they were Southern men, and, you know, carrying on in that way. But the women were these wildly strong women. And I did a lot of watching and witnessing that weekend. And I walked away from that recognizing that these women were like, every one of them was a steel magnolia. Every single one of them. And I walked away with this profound change. I came to understand there wasn't anything wrong with me. That thing where I just won't quit is a genetic, I joke about it now, it's a genetic problem. It's a genetic issue. And I joke with those same cousins. Yeah, it's a genetic problem. They know I'm telling the truth.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then there's the burning bed reference, which is to say that when you are a person that has been mistreated, and I have that, a lot of that in the early part of my story, when you have been treated poorly, when you have been abused, when you have trauma, some of us hunker down and double down, and you might, if you're really thinking, you might cover your head when all of that stuff's going on. But there comes a breaking point. And I have seen that breaking point. And I can't unsee it anymore in myself, in my personality. So if you are going to come at me with some trash, if you are, and I can say it legitimately, if you're going to hit me, honey, you better knock me out, at least. You better knock me out, because when I get back up, and it turns out I will get back up, you're in big trouble. Because I don't have, at that point, I don't have a governor anymore. There's a part of me, no, we're not, I'm not, no. You're not getting away with that. And so the burning bed reference, for those listeners that don't understand what I'm talking about, is a story of a woman who was a true story of a battered woman who had a very similar breaking point, and then her drunken, violent, abusive husband was passed out asleep on the bed. She may or may not have put a couple of sleeping pills in his whiskey that night, and when he was dead, blacked out cold, she poured gasoline on him and on the bed and started it on fire and walked out of the house. Boom. And she went to jail for that, even though there was a long history of battering. And I wish that that was like the only story of that kind of stuff, but it's not. It's not.
And ironically, Janiver, it happened 10 miles from where I live in Dansville, Michigan.
So you know.
Yeah, oh yeah. As soon as you said that. And I'm old enough to remember Farrah Fawcett in the movie too.
And there was a movie of the week. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So, wow. So I think that it's a combination, an answer to your question, and this is a super long-winded answer, but it's not a simple answer.
No, I get it.
A combination of this genetic thing and this part of me that at this stage of my life is just broken. And so I get up and I come back, and I get up and I come back, and I get up and I come back. And if I can't go over it, I'll go under it. And if I can't go under it, I'll go to the right or to the left or whatever. Or I'm just going to stand here and until you go away, and then I'm just going to go ahead and do what I'm going to do. And if you're going to continue to tell me that I can't make any money singing blues, and that's real nice, honey. Those are actual words that, you know, has been said to me more than once. That's nice. Yeah, you're not going to make, no, you can't do that. And I'm like, okay, you just go, you keep believing this whole you can't thing, and I'm going to go over here and do this, and I'll see, check you later, man. And that is long been in me. That's what I can say. You know, my cousins and I joke about it. It's a genetic problem.
Well, Janiva, in preparation for this interview, I'm going to turn the page here a little bit. I was fascinated as I read about your process for writing music. It's truly a creative approach, and I'm sure you would agree with that. I would love to have you share a little bit of that process with us.
I never seem to write songs on my own, not very many. So it's definitely a collaborative process for me. I don't do well sitting in a room with another person trying to hammer stuff out. I've never been able to do that. I get all like freaked out and uncomfortable. I'm too nervous about it. So the idea of like something gets started and gets hit over to me, and then I can work on it, and then I can hit it back, and they can work on it and hit it back. That's how I have written songs. It's the only way that I've written much. I won't say everything, but I'll say the 98% of it. And because I don't play an instrument well enough to fulfill half of the job. I just don't. It's a great regret that I have. I regret that, not learning to play an instrument. It's not like I can't learn now, but I got other issues going on. I got really bad arthritis in my hands. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, playing a guitar or playing a piano, is pretty challenging for me when I'm worrying about, you know, pulling a suitcase through the airport.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm going to move this a little bit because I don't know why I've got this dark, weird shadow. I think the sun is moving.
Oh.
Okay. I can joke about it and say that it's true to say that it usually happens in the wee hours for me. What actually starts to come out when there's no distractions going on, phones, text messages blowing up, whatever, emails coming in. My producer said one time, excuse me, he said one time that basically what you got to do is take a blank piece of paper and set it on your desk and then stare at it until blood comes out of your forehead. It's kind of like that. Yeah.
Wow. One of the things that I love about your approach to music is you understand the importance of bringing your own brand of the blues to the table. In fact, you're quoted as saying, "I will never be Memphis Minnie." Do you think that too many people try to emulate a particular artist in order to find acceptance in the music world?
I don't have a judgment on it like that.
Okay.
I don't see it that way. I understand that emulation is one of the highest compliments that there is. I think if Memphis Minnie knew how many other acoustic guitar players she was a badass, okay, for starters, tried to do, you know, Me and My Chauffeur Blues or any of the Memphis Minnie tunes, it would be, I think she'd be flattered. Emulation is one of the highest forms of flattery.
Sure.
As I understand it. So my way of learning songs early in my career was to learn to sing them note for note like the recording. That can be a tall order.
Yeah,
if you're
yeah.
listening to, you know, Aretha Franklin, it's a tall order. If you're listening to Coco Taylor, I've got a picture of her over there. It's a tall order if you're listening to Denise LaSalle or Irma Thomas. It's a tall order to do that. But my way of learning other people's songs still to this day is to listen to their recording until I can be so deeply inside of it, I can regurgitate it note for note, because that's the baseline. That's where we begin. And then bring myself to it, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, you know, I love Bobby Bland. Love his records. Love B.B. King's records. Love Etta James' records. Love, love, love that stuff. Love Coco Taylor records. Love Howlin' Wolf records. But I'm never going to be those people.
Right.
Those people completely filled that slot. There's no there's nowhere to go, man. There's no room in there. It's magnificent. It's magnificent, Bobby Bland. Two Steps from the Blues, a magnificent album. Oh my God. So, is it true that I've recorded Bobby Bland songs? Yes, it is. Some of the earlier recordings, you know. I'm Not Ashamed. Great song. I'm not ashamed when you saw me cry. So But I'm never going to be him. I'm never going to do it like him. So I have to bring myself to it. I have to be able to bring myself to it in order for it to be real, you know. I love B.B. King. I love Every Day I Have the Blues. What a great song. I would not lose 1 minute of sleep if I never heard a cover blues band do Every Day I Have the Blues again. So if that kind of touches on, I think, where you might have been going with that.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I believe that emulating is a huge compliment. But please don't stop there. Please don't stop there. What else you got? Because you're never going to be B.B. King. I got news. I mean, I don't want to be the one to... You're never going to be Bobby Bland. You're never going to be Coco Taylor. You're not. You're not. Cut it out. You're never going to be Etta. You shouldn't just stop. So that's kind of where I'm at with that. I hope that makes sense.
No, absolutely does. Now, I have to ask you about Jim Alfredson. Of course, Jim is former member of the legendary Root Doctor Band here in Michigan. Yeah. And I know that he's toured with you on occasion and even appeared on a couple of your albums. But how did that connection come to be? And what does he bring to the table out there on the road for you?
Jimmy was one of the happiest accidents ever. I call him Jimmy.
It's okay.
I had a regular Hammond player. I was touring, you know, a fair amount. I want to, like, just do that and go back. Here we go. I was touring a fair amount. And my then Hammond player, who had been with me, I think, 5 years, called me up and he said, I can't do that tour. And I was like, wait, what? He was like, I can't do it. And I'm like, what the F are you talking about, dude? You have to do, I can't, there, you know, what are you doing? Are you quitting? No, but I just can't do that tour. Look, here's what's going on. My daughter is graduating from college and I've got to go. She'll never speak to me again. My wife will never speak to me again. I gotta go. And I was like, stab me in the eye with a chopstick. Okay. You're going to have to recommend somebody to me because I don't even know where to start. And there isn't really enough time to pull this off. Thanks for the not enough advance notice, my friend. I didn't know how to tell you. I'm like, okay. All right. So he gives me a couple of names. I think he gave me like three names of three cats. I call first guy's like, yeah, I can't. I'm already booked. I'm like, okay, thanks. I appreciate it. Next guy, ring, ring. No, I can't. I'm already booked. And I'm like, okay. And I'm looking at my road manager, who is my bassist of many, many long years. And I'm looking at him going, what are we going to do? What am I going to do? What are we going to do, man? He goes, I don't know what to tell you. Let's call the third number. Ugh. I call the third number and the guy goes, well, I am available. And I went, okay. I'm instantly going, this guy just sounds, he sounds too straight. He just sounds too square, man. But keyboard players, generally, organ players, piano players, they're the blockheads. They're the square dude. Right? They're the geeks. They're the total geeks, generally, you know. And I go, okay, well, here's the thing. Da-da-da-da-da. Starts in St. Louis. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I can fly you in. It's this many dates. This is what I'll pay you. I can send you the music. I need everything learned. This is not a jam session. And if you don't learn this stuff and you show up to this gig, I'll personally bury you in the snow. And the guy's like, he's like, no, I'll do my homework and I can do it. And I was like, oh my God. Drive the van from LA to St. Louis. First show's in St. Louis. Go to the airport, pick this guy up. He's total blockhead, total square. You know, just like nice looking guy. And you know, doesn't appear to have one road mile on him, by the way. He just is just clean cut, you know. And he plays the gig and he plays it cold. And everybody, all the four of us in the band are like, what? Guitar player, bass player, drummer, all separately come to me and they go, get that guy. Get that guy. Can he play some more shows? He was so great. And I was like, oh man, you know, let me see. And so that's where it started with Jimmy, which is an affirmation of the theory that is said when you're on tour was never get out of the bus. Don't get out of the bus, man, because you might not be getting back in. And we laugh about that. The first gig in St. Louis, we were playing, and it was a whiteout blizzard. You all know what that is in Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff was coming sideways. There was no snow going. It was like moving that way. And so there was hardly anybody at the gig because, you know, on the snow, the roads were like, it was, you know, there were like warnings on the news and stuff. Don't go anywhere. Stay home. We're like driving from the hotel to the club. We play the gig. We are miles away at the hotel from downtown St. Louis. And we're still in the van and the snow's still going sideways. And all of a sudden he pipes up from the back and he goes, I might have a problem. And we're like, what, man? What happened? And he goes, I can't find my wallet.
Oh, no.
And we all look at him. We go, what are you talking about? And he's like, I think I left it on the organ. Because his habit was to take the wallet out of his pocket and set it on top of the rig. Oh my God, we had to drive back in that snowstorm and go get his wallet, and there it was. And he still hears about that. We still tease him about that to this day. But that was years ago, and Jimmy's done a lot of miles with me. A lot of miles, and I'm really, really grateful. He has contributed so much. All the guys make huge contributions, and yes, he has recorded on, I believe it's more than two albums. This album coming out here on March 28th is my 17th album.
Wow.
So it's that Michigan work ethic, man. It's keep your nose down and keep working.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's time to turn the page one more time. March 28th, you have a brand new album coming out, number 17. The title is called Back for Me, which is interesting in itself. Oh, look, she's got one. She's teasing us. Look at this. Talk about this new album, if you would, please.
Sure. Da, da, da. Just want folks to see.
Yeah.
Comes in CD and vinyl, and then all on the streaming, blah, 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 all of that kind of stuff. It's all over that place as well. This is a return to interpreting other people's songs. I didn't co-write anything on here.
Okay.
There are some of my favorite kind of songs on here. What I'm referring to is, and you'll understand this, is B-sides.
Mm-hmm.
Of other people. So there's like a B-side of an Irma Thomas song called Hitting on Nothing. You know, there's B-sides of, you know, Ann Peebles' tune called Do I Need You? You know, yeah. I'm really happy with it. I'm really, really pleased with how it came out. And this is what folks are going to be hearing when they come and see us on tour. So that's pretty exciting.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say the vinyl. I don't have the vinyl yet. I'm still waiting on delivery. But the vinyl is super cool because, like, that's the album cover. The vinyl album cover looks like that. But the actual vinyl itself, ooh, it's gold. So I'm telling you,
wow.
Damn it, I got a gold record. I finally got a gold record. It's not the same kind of gold record that they talk about. Well, it's gold. No, that used to be a reference for the number of albums sold.
Sure.
Gold, you know, and then after that, the next level you used to be able to go to was platinum. But it's gold. I'm telling you, I got my gold record. I finally got my gold record.
That's cool. Now, I'm certain that there's many out there wanting information on pre-ordering this new album.
Yes.
Maybe they want to buy some merch, find more information about you, or even book you for a gig. Where do we send them for all of this?
The best place to go is janavamagnus.com. J-A-N-I-V like Victor, A-M like Mary, A-G-N like Nancy, E-S-S, two S's on the end there. There's a Scottish sign off right there, isn't there? So janavamagnus.com. It's got all the touring information and the contact info. There's a store there. In terms of specifically pre-ordering, that's done on the record company's website, but once the 28th of March hits, everything's available on my website. So if you want to pre-order it, it's Blue Elan Records. So you go to blueelan.com, BLUEELAN.com. Yeah, there's two E's in the middle of it.
Okay. Well, I will make sure to put the proper links in there for you on this
Thank
episode.
You.
And
Thank
let me
you.
Tell you, I am a fan of vinyl, okay?
Okay.
It's one of my first pieces of vinyl that I had. I had no vinyl on April 8th of last year.
Yeah.
I have almost 400 pieces of vinyl now. And I am a firm believer in supporting our musicians. So yeah. I promise you that I will be going and getting a copy of this ordered as soon as we're done this evening. But Janava Magnus, it has indeed been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thanks.
One of the longest episodes that I have recorded to date, and that's a good thing. No, that's okay. A good thing. There's so many good nuggets of gold in this interview, and I wish you much continued success, and I genuinely look forward to seeing you locally down the road sometime.
I don't know when we're coming to Michigan, but I sure, you know, whenever the opportunity comes across my radar, I am sweetly reasonable.
And you gotta call Jim and have him come and even just sit in and play one. I would love to see that.
He's on the road with me. He's leaving the 15th of March. He's out of there. We're going out for 3 weeks. And
nice.
I'm working on some stuff for Europe this year, so I'm very excited. Would love to come back to Michigan. Get me a gig.
We're going to have to try to do that. I've got a few friends in the state here. Maybe I can get them to bring you in. I think that'd be wonderful.
I'm ready. I'm always ready.
Well, as we close this episode, let me tell you briefly about the VFW National Home. It's located in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, the only Eaton Rapids on earth, and they are celebrating 100 years of serving. The VFW National Home assists military veterans and their families with children by creating a foundation of services and resources to achieve their personal and family goals in order to move forward in a positive, safe, and healthy environment. Yes, that is their mission statement. And I have personally seen this in operation firsthand. They can use your support. So please do me a favor and consider making a tax-deductible donation today to the VFW National Home so they can continue this valuable work. A link to their website is on the information section of this YouTube channel. And thank you very much for your consideration. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, our thanks to Janava Magnus, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, Keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, my friends.
Thanks, Jim.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Ervin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm trying, trying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm